Good afternoon. We're going to start off the this session with a talk from Andrew Renton, who's Head of Applied Arts at the National Museum of Wales in Cardiff. Thank you.
Yes, I'm the museum curator you couldn't shake off, I'm afraid. Before I start, I'd just like to credit a few people whose images I'm going to use while we're getting started. The Craft Study Centre, Sarah Yunan, Robert Teed, and David Cushway. And I hope those here who know which images they are, thank you to you. My title today could perhaps more correctly be Ceramics Artists and the National Museum of Wales. But in any case, it echoes a phrase in Joran Weiterberg's essay from last year's Ceramics in the Expanded Field Seminar, where she writes, "What ends up in museums is important because museum collections serve as our collective memory bank. Questions should therefore always be raised about how museum curators exercise their power as writers of history and stewards of our memories." So if I'm standing here as a museum curator and I'm some sort of collective memory bank manager, who holds accounts with me? What processes of artistic investment and profit-taking take place? What is the actual and proper role of the artist in this context? With these questions in mind, I'll describe examples of how ceramics have figured in the engagement between artists and the National Museum of Wales. Museum curators have worked enthusiastically with artists, as we all know, for 20 years or more, particularly since, inspired by Michel Foucault and others, we ourselves began to question the authority embodied in our own institutions. In a key museological text from 1991, Karp and Levine's Exhibiting Cultures, Carol Duncan reminds us why we thought it important to do this. She writes, "To control a museum means the power to define and rank people, to declare some as having greater share than others in the community's common heritage, in its very identity. Those who are in the greatest accord with the museum's version of what is beautiful and good may partake of this greater identity. It is they who are best prepared to recognize the history presented by the program and who have most cultivated the skills to produce the particular kinds of associations or, as the case may be, the aesthetic attention implicitly demanded by the museum's isolated objects. In short, those who best understand how to use art in the museum environment are also those on whom the museum ritual confers this greater and better identity." In response to such arguments, museum curators have sought ways to moderate this authoritative power of museums and look to the questioning, risk-taking, even disruptive potential of artists. But when Duncan writes, "Those who best understand how to use art in the museum environment are also those on whom the museum ritual confers this greater and better identity," couldn't she be describing artists? Does the curator who opens museum collections to the creative scrutiny of artists risk simply creating a new class of insider authority figure? Founded in 1907, the National Museum of Wales opened to the public in 1922. From the start, artists influenced the way in which it was conceived and presented. Most obviously the sculptor William Goscombe John, who donated numerous works by himself and his new sculpture friends. He had, as you can see in this image from the 1920s here, he had his own drummer boy take centre stage in the museum's entrance hall and was largely responsible for this space assuming the character of a memorial to the First World War. The museum first engaged with a ceramic artist in 1913 when Bernard Leach was in correspondence from Japan with the museum's founding director, his uncle, Dr. William Evans Hoyle. In a long and fascinating letter, Leach shared with Hoyle his desire to enlighten the West about Japanese aesthetics, convincing Hoyle to fund his purchase for the museum of a complete collection of tea ceremony, chanoyu, paraphernalia, as well as prints and other items which would offer a rounded insight into Japanese art. Leach was concerned to do something unique, unlike, for example, the V&A's characteristically Victorian taxonomic display of its Japanese ceramics by place of manufacture. Leach wrote, "The chanoyu collection will, I think, be something unique. They have something of the sort here in the museum, but it's very poor and does not give the spirit of Charnayu. So this is an item in the museum's collection, and you'll see Leach's annotation of the box for the tea canister, a sort of anglicized version of a Japanese tradition. Strongly influenced by Okakura Kakazo's The Book of Tea, Leach was interested in cultural and aesthetic authenticity, in providing insight into an apparently genuine Japan that was fast disappearing. The museum became an early vehicle for what he would define as his life's work, the task of creating a bridge between East and West. With Hoyle, Leach discussed kazari, traditional Japanese ideas about display, which the Charnayu set would embody for a Western audience. Engaging with principles of museum display, he insisted that the objects be shown exactly as he specified. He wrote, "The reason I have insisted upon the Charnayu collection is that it includes diverse articles of purely Japanese character and really good taste in one homogeneous set, suitable for a small display. I beg of you to follow this as nearly as possible, for not only are the details minute and subtle, even meticulous, but they are absolutely calculated to display each and all the things to the very best advantage." This was an isolated collaboration, however. Not until the 1980s did the museum again interact in depth with ceramic artists. Mick Casson was invited to advise on the use and development of the collections, an influential role subsequently filled by Edmund Duval and now Claire Kanin. One focus of the museum's recent collecting strategy has been acquiring contemporary work that interrogates the historic collections. The Welsh ceramics collection seems particularly able to inspire artistic practice. For example, works like this Swansea porcelain cabaret tea service of about 1820 influenced Cardiff-based Morgan Hall, with apologies for the amateur photo. And after studying our densely displayed Welsh ceramics gallery, including this Nantgarw tea service acquired by the Prince Regent's brother in 1818, Lowry Davis made her Nantgarw collection, which explores the gently nationalistic nostalgia and collecting fervour that Welsh porcelain and the museum itself inspire. The museum actively encourages this practice. In 2002, we invited Claire Kanin to make something for the museum that reflects the significance of the museum to her own practice. She focused in part on early 19th century Welsh porcelain, decorated with prints or painted flowers and gilding, as you can see here, but also looked beyond ceramics to Gwen John's portraits, whose affinity with her own figures is clear. The resulting piece is a ceramic metaphor for the fragility of the human condition, but also embodies the interaction between museum collection and artistic practice, and is therefore an eloquent addition to that collection. The museum's visual arts partnership scheme with institutions around Wales also prompts artistic engagement with its collections, offering generous access to collections and devolving curatorial and creative responsibility to the partners and artists. In the exhibition Brought to Light at Oriel Mostyn, Llandudno in 2005, Mark Rees's autobiographical installation, Supper Set Site, revisited the domestic decor of his upbringing in the Swansea Valley. The 1970s dining table from his parents' kitchenette was laid with a Swansea pottery supper set of about 1805 from the National Museum's collection, chosen because of its Swansea origin and the vibrant orange colour, which was an obsession of his mother. 2009's Artist Object Project, in partnership with the University of Glamorgan and Brecknock Museum Brecon, invited three artists, Catherine Bertola, Michael Cousin and Deirdre Nelson, to show in Brecon new work made in response to the National Museum's historic ceramics collections. The troubled history of porcelain production at Nantgarw near Cardiff between 1814 and 1823, and the precarious survival of the site next to the busy A470, stimulated embroiderer Deirdre Nelson to expand her practice beyond familiar territory. Her sound piece Shift, in collaboration with Matt Hulse, used recorded traffic noise to vibrate some of the very many shards from the factory site. You can see up on the right. Working with local ceramic designer and maker Matt Thompson, she also produced plates decorated with typical Nantgarw pink roses but left 9/10 blank to reflect the 90% kiln losses experienced at Mangaru. Catherine Bertola's wallpaper, Blue Babylonica, drew inspiration from Welsh blue and white print and pottery. It hung behind a vitrine of pottery owned by local people and curated by Catherine herself. This site-specific installation was in effect a temporary museum collection, cataloguing personal meanings invested in objects by the local population. Michael Cousin used a Swansea pottery jug printed with satirical images of Napoleon's defeat as the basis for a video work satirising contemporary attitudes to the H1N1 virus. The National Museum also hosted a conference, The Go-Between, Artist as Mediator Between Collections and Audiences. A flavour of the published papers is given by ceramic artist Daniel Allen's slightly provocative suggestion that, I quote, whilst uniting the museum with its public, the burden of the artist to act as communicator on and in public spaces is also in part due to the modern curator's desire to facilitate change. Artists are seemingly given more freedom to navigate through the red tape that continues to paralyze the curator. By doing so, the curator has someone to blame or hide behind when questions are asked. No comment. Artist engagement with our collections extends beyond high-profile, short-term projects to the less visible, more open-ended terrain of student projects. Sarah Unan's recent MA at Cardiff School of Art and Design pursued a fascination with this late 18th century creamware bonbonniere, or sweet box, formed as a woman's head, an object normally in store away from the public gaze. Sarah's PhD is now exploring the potential of 3D scanning and printing to foster new ways for audiences to engage with museum artifacts. 3D scanning creates an electronic clone of interestingly uncertain status, from which any number of physical copies can be printed in media like resin, plastic, even clay itself. The process allows Sarah to mess with the object's DNA, recreating it on different scales, altering its structure, leaving a pixelated surface in celebration of the making process. She plays with the notion of possession, speaking of appropriating pieces from the ceramics collection. Some examples assert, like the one that now sits on my desk, "Je ne suis plus votre bonbonnière," I am no longer your sweet box. So she questions the object's identity, its individuality, and its biography. She challenges the museum's authority and custodianship, but goes further, seeking to confront the museum artifact directly, making intervention possible, I'm using her words here, making intervention possible at the level of the museum object itself, rather than solely at the moment of display. So back to my own words, a core raison d'etre of the museum, collecting, safeguarding and making accessible material artifacts and specimens, persists alongside the increasingly virtual and digital reality in which we exist. Sarah argues that recent developments in rapid prototyping are bridging the gap between digital and physical objects. Her research will explore how 3D scanning and printing might stimulate museum visitors to participate more actively in shaping their own experiences of museum collections. Edmund de Waal's project, Arcanum, mapping 18th century European porcelain at the National Museum in 2005, developed from an extended engagement with the museum and a growing fascination with its large collection of 18th century European porcelain given in the early 20th century by the Welsh banker Wilfred de Winton. Arcanum became an intimate study of a type of porcelain which was somewhat mysterious to him, but whose layers of meaning and whose beauty began to enthrall him. It meant navigating the mind of a compulsive collector whose vast collection challenged the museum's capacity to manage it, and whose idiosyncratic taxonomic approach organized the collection by decorative type in order, in Edmund's words, to reveal the matrix of connections between different European porcelain factories. This is a card catalogue system that currently lives in my desk drawer. In the 1920s, a two-story room was specially designed for the collection. As Edmund observed, this gallery, elegant and respectful, tells us about the museum's confidence in the collection. In other words, confidence in the intellectual values it embodied. Edmund's work on the de Winton collection was timely, as the museum was also rethinking what to do with it. It was obvious from the antiquated, rigidly academic display that you can see here, that the collection had fallen on hard times, perceived, as the title Arcanum suggests, as secretive and elitist. This was a story guaranteed to beguile Edmund, as you can probably imagine, who relished the chance to reanimate the collection. He witnessed the strangely poignant removal of these old porcelain displays, and as the galleries were emptied, he prepared new work that would interrogate the de Winton collection. Edmund on the left, 18th century French on the right. Edmund considered the display and architectural placement of 18th century European porcelain, the formality that went with its use. He tested the limits of the museum's comfort zone, challenging our prejudices about how to present historic objects. He had us put 18th century porcelain out from behind glass on open display and lit the gallery with nothing but natural daylight. He wrote, "This project comes out of the shared belief that ceramics have been poorly served in museums. Why, when we see ceramics in museums, do we see so much glass? Above all, why are the objects so sad? And why do they look the same?" I noticed he used the word "the shared belief" that ceramics have been poorly served. So it was very much a collaborative venture. Discovering in the objects a subtly differentiated spectrum of whites, he researched a new palette of 17 different white glazes. Parts of objects normally unseen revealed to him the hidden and often complex social lives of these objects. He wrote, "Together there is a blur of information, of claim and counterclaim, of ownership and inheritance, emblems from a factory, pattern numbers, decorators' initials, decorators' inventory numbers, collectors' inventory numbers, dealers' labels, museums' accession numbers, museums' renumbering. All this interplay of knowledge framed within this discreet and beautiful footering." Edmund introduced informality and spontaneity, encouraged visitors to respond instinctively to these usually diffident objects. "This is not an exhibition of highlights," he said, "not an exhibition that contextualizes, not an exhibition that historicizes. It is a collection of personal, episodic responses to this porcelain, a mapping alongside other maps." So he displayed this teapot upside down, hand-wrote non-academic text directly onto the lining fabric of the showcases. "These are things I like a lot. These are things I dislike. These are things that confuse me." He varied the dynamics of display, balancing, in his words, the singular and the many. So the entrance to the exhibition, for example, was about massed taxonomic display. Showcases stuffed like storage cupboards with objects arranged by decorative category, using de Winton's system. Taking as object labels the museum's original index cards for de Winton's taxonomic system. This porcelain wall was Edmund's own personal taxonomy of whites and subtle marks. He explained, "It has a perverse logic to it, a catalogue of marks and indentations, a spectrum of different whites, and an allusion to the faded fabric we saw before." The wall became a keystone of the renewed ceramics displays, finding its ways into an unused upsidal niche. An example of how Arcanum prompted us to respect the architecture more, to vary the rhythms of display, to interpret with a lighter touch when we came to renew the ceramics displays. Edmund wrote of his project, "allowing for moments of clarity, provisional clarity, but clarity nonetheless." This term, provisional clarity, could be a useful guiding principle for the museum curator. Not everything we do is forever and for certain. We ourselves can and should be prepared to be open-minded and experimental. This seems obvious now, that perhaps it took what felt like an intimate and shared learning experience to make such lessons concrete. Thus, for Elizabeth Fritsch's personally curated retrospective in 2010, the dynamic between curator, artist and ceramics was more confident. We gave her freedom to produce ceramic theatre of a radically different character, with most of the objects on open display. Liz was keen to juxtapose her work with paintings from the collection, making a point about the positioning and categorising of her work within this and other museum collections. We used Ben Nicholson's two forms of 1940-43, which you can see here, but could and probably should have taken the idea further. I'll finish with Cardiff-based artist David Cushway, the primary focus of whose practice is clay and ceramics, but for whom the relationship between artist and museum has become a key concern. Cush's video diptych, Teacup 1 and Teacup 2, was made in 2007 using ultra-high-speed cameras to film two cups as they fell and shattered. Hugely slowed down and run forwards and backwards, the films present an entrancing process of breaking and reforming. The constant cycle of life and death is a phrase that Cush has used of his work. After acquiring the work, the museum showed it in the Gallery of Historic Welsh Ceramics, framing the twin Sony cubes inside a showcase as a metaphor for the way we in general, we the museum, seek to reconstruct and control fragmented knowledge. It is an explicit example of a reverse intervention, in inverted commas, the museum intervening in the work of art, asserting control over its meaning by blatantly recontextualizing it. Glenn R. Brown's essay from last year, Intervention, Interaction and the Will to Preserve, points out the sensitivity of ceramic makers to, in his words, the paradox of displaying ceramic vessels in museum vitrines, and more significantly, of thereby detaching those objects from the milieu that confers on them a primary purpose. He asks, are there ways in which functional vessels, now sheathed securely against time by museum glass, might be revivified, at least temporarily, through return to actual use? What would be the consequences of enacting such strategies, both for historical objects and for the cultural ethos that desires their preservation? Well, in answer to that question, I'll show you this image, which is a short clip from a recent work by Cush, Tea Time at the Museum, in which Cush and I drink tea from a 200-year-old Swansea porcelain tea set. I'm going to show you a couple of minutes of an extract from that. He's produced a 19-20 minute
the museum collection.
So we'll just play it and I'll comment on it.
In terms of us taking something out of the collection and using it in this way, it's quite a simple question. How does it make you feel?
I feel like I'm being a bit naughty. You know, it's like an act of transgression. I'm sort of breaking the rules of how we should handle and look after these objects, keeping them clean and protecting them at all costs. So making tea in the teapot, sort of goes against those instincts that I have as a curator to protect the object.
In terms of when artists are invited into a museum, do you think that that's their role, in effect, to kind of break rules? Or because I see what we're doing here is almost a kind of a subversion of the museum structure, the museum power, as it were.
Yeah.
In that we're taking something. The role of a museum might be to about conservation and protection, and then an artist comes along and says, "Can we reuse the objects for their intended purpose?"
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, although as curators we have these rules and we follow the rules as closely as we can for most of the time, I think I can't pretend that we're not all curious or intrigued about the possibility of doing things differently, and I think bringing artists into the museum helps us investigate what we're actually curious about ourselves, and in a way it gives us permission to try new things out. I think as curators we would feel, you know, we can't be seen as a curator to go out on a limb and try something radical, but by working with an artist we can give ourselves permission to try things out.
That's quite interesting, that it's kind of an exterior force acting on the museum structure in a way by inviting an artist into these. I was just going to talk about the kind of wider collection where everything, we talked briefly about protection there for a moment and conservation.
The whole thing is quite interesting and I recommend it, but we can't show it all now. But we'll keep playing it and eventually you'll see objects being used, if only briefly. So anyway, we talk about curators, or I talk about curators like me, using artists to give themselves, to give we the curators permission to indulge our curiosity and to push at the boundaries of conventional museum practice. In retrospect, this seems, on my part, too diffident, lacking in confidence and initiative. But perhaps this self-realisation is one of the key benefits of interacting with artists. What began as a subversion of the museum's power, its structure and disciplines, became a sensory celebration of touch, weight, fineness, temperature, movement, sound, a reanimation of neutralised objects, a reassertion of their identity, of the teapot as a teapot. I also suggest a comparison between Kush and me on the one hand, and priests at a mass on the other, performing for an audience excluded from use of the objects. Had our act of subversion ended with the artist being co-opted into the system as another gatekeeper or source of authority? Was the whole thing a little too cosy? Glenn Brown makes a similar point. He says, as it opened a legitimate space for itself among contemporary art genre, the intervention shed all appearance of outsider status and became recognised for what it had been from its inception, an inside avenue to institutional self-critique. It stopped well short of placing the museum itself at stake. Kush responded that through the medium of the film, the objects communicate in a new way to a wider audience. This is certainly true, and a good outcome for the museum. And even if it is cosy, as long as we're honest about what is happening, shouldn't we be happy? After all, haven't we argued that alternative perspectives should be integrated into museum practice? We can see the museum curator moving away from the role of definitive authority towards that, as Kush observes, of mediator between artist, object and audience. The museum may see the artist as mediator between museum, object and audience. The relationship is a fluid and ideally an egalitarian one, suggesting a growing convergence between curatorial and artistic practices. To return to the banking metaphor, the investments made and the profits taken flow in both directions, and in other directions too. Even as an apparent antagonist, the artist is a knowing and informed interlocutor whose relationship with the museum is fundamentally a symbiotic one, and whose disruptive potential is something to be welcomed. In a revealing recent discussion, Nick Thornton, my contemporary fine art counterpart in Cardiff, expressed surprise at my own diffidence about intervening, in inverted commas, creatively in the collections, and my feeling that this was the proper role of the artist. This contrasted with Nick's own practice, which we, the applied art people, are now seeking to emulate, exploiting the capacity of the applied art collections to operate on an equal footing to the fine art collections in the museum's new sequence of contemporary art galleries, perhaps beginning to elide what may increasingly be seen as arbitrary collection categories. In the next few years, applied art, and ceramics specifically, will at times take a lead in our ambitious programming of contemporary art, an opportunity for us as curators to be bold and innovative, and for artists to develop projects that further interrogate the kind of issues we are discussing today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd never thought of a curator as a bank manager before, so I had to think through that.
Scary thought.
Any questions? I was intrigued. That was very interesting, the way in which you discovered the correspondence between Leech and the museum back in, was it 1913?
Yeah.
Because maybe there's a cautionary note there in terms of artists almost, you know, having a kind of symbiotic relationship. Because on one hand, Leech is claiming to preserve the past, a way of life that's disappearing in Japan.
Mm.
But it's also he was also promoting directly, indirectly his own work, and certainly the kind of Mingay, the early days of the Mingay movement, because it was in that kind of early formation of his kind of his own actual practice. So there are various agendas at work, aren't there, in terms of how one can potentially kind of build or even rebuild a museum and a collection to reflect, you know, to reflect, you know, supposedly a kind of, you know, a new position.
Sorry,
it's more an observation.
Yeah,
I don't know
if
you have anything, you know, in response to that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I should also credit Emmanuel Cooper here, because it was in research for his biography of Leech that he prompted the connection to be made between correspondence at the Craft Study Centre and correspondence at the National Museum. So I think that should be said. It was interesting. It's you were talking about going. I think you were talking about sort of going back, reviving something that had happened before. And
well, presumably Leech was claiming that by showing the tea set, you were the museum was going to kind of preserve and demonstrate, you know, a disappearing way of life in Japan.
Mm.
But it was also promoting the philosophy behind the Mingay movement, which he was part of in its very early days.
Yeah.
So it was, you can read it in a variety of different ways, the motivation behind that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is, in my view, this is Leech possibly in the most interesting phase of his career, when he was still unformed as a ceramic artist and very much trying to decide what his future was. And all kinds of interesting ideas. If you read his diaries and correspondence at that period, there's lots of interesting and surprisingly open-minded things that he was thinking and saying, if you look in the light of what he was doing before. I don't know, it's difficult to know whether he was looking ahead to the future in any kind of long-term way, or whether he was simply thinking in terms of one particular display of one particular collection. I mean, it would have been fascinating to see how it might have developed had his uncle, who died early, if his uncle had been at the museum for longer and Leech had been able to engage more with him as Leech became more established. That would have been an interesting thing to pursue.
Oh, well, future work.
Yeah.
We have a question.
On the 20-minute final edit that I have seen, I don't think we go that far. But you have to ask Crush that to see whether he captured that magic moment on film. But yes. I think the tablecloth wasn't to try to prettify it particularly. It was just to disguise a fairly unsightly table. But what the film does start off with is me taking the objects out of the showcase, and I'm wearing my curatorial gloves. I unlock the case, carry the objects over to the table, take the gloves off, and we've kind of made the transition to a different state of mind by the time we sit down.
Any further questions? Yes, we have one at the back.
Yes.
I think that's a very good question, and I ended up editing out of what I read for time reasons and perhaps for other reasons, but I did consider whether, you know, to what extent the artist is a role model for wider public engagement with collections, and that thought did occur to me, I have to say. I don't think there's any particular reason why the public shouldn't be invited to do that sort of thing. And I should also point out another work by Cush, just to make the point that he is aware of these issues as well. He did a video piece called The Last Supper, which was filming ordinary people and some members of staff at the Glyn Vivian Art Gallery in Swansea, sitting at a table with a favourite ceramic object on the table in front of them, looking at the object, discussing, talking about the object, at a time when the Glyn Vivian was closing down for a period of refurbishment. So I think, you know, that is a model that we could also emulate in other ways. We are, a colleague of mine, Rachel Conroy, is currently in the process of developing an idea for kind of drop-in handling sessions in the Welsh Ceramics Gallery for members of the public, and on an experimental basis. It'll be interesting to see how that goes, and starting off in a fairly unstructured way, but it might develop into something more formal that might, you know, might be recorded discussions or whatever. So, but good point. We are interested in that.
Can we carry on with these questions in the